This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Or you can give us a call, 860-275-7266. Colin McEnroe is away this week, so we've got a great panel of folks to talk about the news. We're also live on Facebook Live today, and the cameras of CTN are here. And I think we're also on Telemundo and Nickelodeon this morning. Bilal Sakhu is here. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford. Hello there, Bilal.
Good morning.
And welcome back. This is your second time this week in this very spot, as a matter of fact.
Exactly.
So we heard from you earlier this week in The Wheelhouse. Susan Bigelow is here. She's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there, Susan.
Good morning.
And Christine Stewart, the boss, the editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, is here as well. Hello, Christine.
Hi, John.
Well, we're going to start with the big event of this past weekend, where Democrats got together in their political convention, and Ned Lamont came out of the convention with 87% of the delegate votes compared to Joe Ganim's 13% or so. That means that Ganim fell 2% short of the 15 that he needed for an automatic primary. Ganim now has one path forward in the governor's race, collecting the signatures of more than 15,000 registered Democrats by June 12th, which is coming up fast. After accepting the party's endorsement at Saturday's convention, Lamont, well, he didn't seem thrilled by the possibility of facing Ganim in a primary this summer. Here's a clip.
I don't think it's great necessarily for the party unless there's some really big issues worth debating. But if Joe wants the primary, we'll have a primary. That'll make the Republicans happy.
Okay, that'll make the Republicans happy. I don't know, is Ned Lamont unhappy about the fact that he doesn't come out completely coronated at this convention? I guess, Christine, I assumed that Joe Ganim was going to get into this one way or the other.
Yeah, I think that Joe always had his intention to run for governor, and he was going to do it no matter what anyone said. And, you know, he thought that he might be able to get the delegates at the convention. He fell short. You know, he had his Bridgeport delegation locked down of city employees who were casting their votes for him. You know, it's a hard task to get more than 15,000 signatures of registered Democrats. It's not unheard of. And it should be interesting to see what happens with this process, whether he actually is able to accomplish that.
Okay, let's dig in a little bit to some of what Ned said, though, there before we get into some of the other stuff that was happening at the convention. When he says, you know, I don't think it's great necessarily for the party unless there's some really big issues worth debating. Well, isn't that kind of the point? I mean, we really haven't heard, I don't think, from Ned Lamont very much as now the presumed nominee of the Democratic Party, much about debating the issues at all. At least a primary with Joe Ganim gives him the chance, the possibility, us the chance to hear what he has to say about that.
It does give him an opportunity. I guess it would make him you know, potentially have to spend money when he doesn't want to have to spend money. He's not using public financing. He's doing his own. He's raising money on his own. You know, but I think that hearing what he has to say, having a public debate, that actually might be good for his candidacy going forward because it would differentiate him from the Republicans. And I think Dan Malloy said some very complimentary things about Ned Lamont and the progress that Ned Lamont has made in understanding public policy and the state government.
What do you think about that, Bilal? The fact that we really haven't heard too much, at least from the Democratic side, about how we're going to differentiate that party from the Republicans, what exactly Ned Lamont is going to do for the state, you know, outside of I'd like to be governor of the state.
Right. I think Christine is right that the process should allow, you know, the candidates from both parties to articulate what their vision is for the state. And so hopefully we'll get into the meat and potatoes of that. You know, the state faces some serious challenges. I mean, we've got a structural fiscal problem here within the state. We've got affordability issues around things like housing. We've got infrastructure needs in the state. We've got just a wide range of challenges in front of us. And so these candidates need to define what their agenda is and how they will respond to these really troubling sort of dimensions to the challenges that Connecticut faces.
It is kind of funny to me that Ned Lamont, of all people, is saying, well, we don't really need to having a primary may not be the best thing in the world. Maybe we should, you know, wouldn't be good for the party. That's how he made his name, was through a primary with Joe Lieberman. I don't think that he wants to have a primary because he doesn't want to deal with it. He wants to just have the party behind him. He wanted to be coronated. I also think that there's a lot of, you know, he probably doesn't want to get into all the baggage the Democratic Party has already. He doesn't want to deal with the fact that there's all of this history and all these problems, because he has yet to really articulate a way forward out of that. And maybe he's not ready to do so without making that contrast with the Republicans.
I think that that's what he's working on. You know, I think that he is focusing his message. And I think we saw some of that in his acceptance speech at the convention, his remarks regarding GE, that he's taking a stand that GE did not leave because of Connecticut's tax structure. So, you know, of course he was attacked by Republicans for that. So, but I think that he's beginning to he's going to inherit a $4.5 billion deficit. When he steps into office, and he's going to have to figure out how to make sure that the teachers' retirement fund doesn't require a $6 billion payment, which it will do in the next few years. So it's tough. I don't know how you do it. I don't know why anyone's running for governor.
But at the same time, strategically, I mean, who wants to be primaried? I mean, no candidate really wants that. They want an opportunity to have the coronation occur. You know, the problem with primaries is that your opponent may beat you up in ways that could damage you in the general election. And so from that standpoint, you know, Ned probably doesn't want that. But I think from the perspective of the voters and the people in the state who really want to know how he will deal with these challenges that the state faces, a primary and a healthy sort of debate is a good thing. But I'm not sure that candidates necessarily want that.
Yeah, I think if you go back and you look at former Lieutenant Governor Mike Fedeli's run against Tom Foley and the baggage that he was able to bring up about the bib company down in Georgia and Tom Foley's management of that, that was pretty damaging going forward into the general election.
So of course, Ned Lamont won at the convention. He was pretty pleased with that, but he couldn't have been pleased with some of the negative reaction by many party delegates to his selection of Susan Bisewitz as his running mate. Bisewitz got the endorsement for lieutenant governor, but it wasn't by an overwhelming margin. She got 59% of the vote. Eva Bermudez-Zimmerman got 40% to easily qualify for a primary. In part, the late surge for Zimmerman was on account of Lamont not choosing a person of color with him at the top of the ticket. Now, here's Bisewitz, who is white, attempting to address this particular controversy.
I would contrast our ticket any day of the week with the Republican ticket. It's all men, all white men, and one white woman running. And you'll see that we'll have beautiful diversity in the Democratic Party.
I have to say, Susan, when I heard beautiful diversity, it sounds an awful lot like something I hear Donald Trump say whenever he's trying to...
The best diversity.
The best. We got the best diversity here, all the best diversity. That's a little... She doesn't sound pleased with the challenge. Let's just put it that way.
No. And she's very defensive about it. But people were kind of expecting, I think, that there were conversations people were having with Ned Lamont that he might pick a person of color for his running mate. Obviously, picking Susan Bisewitz was the smart political thing to do, but it made a lot of people really unhappy. There was a big sense of betrayal I could see among people in the Democratic Party. And that's so awkward, especially for Susan Bisewitz, who didn't actually manage to win in with an overwhelming number among Democratic delegates who are kind of like her people. So it's not a strong endorsement
for
her.
I have to ask Christina, it was a smart political thing to do in terms of getting a potential opponent in a primary off the table. Is it a smart political thing to do when you have someone who has some of the baggage that Susan Bisewitz has and you say, okay, I'm going to run with you. There's no clear, I don't think we can call it chemistry between the two people at the top of the ticket. I mean, it's smart politics in one way, but I don't know.
I don't think they actually played it all out in their head when they decided, I'm going to choose Susan Bisewitz. I think that prior to that, they had conversations with Eva Bermudez-Zimmerman. They had also had conversations with New Haven Mayor Tony Harp, who decided not to run for lieutenant governor. They had conversations with Senator Gary Winfield, who also made a decision not to run for lieutenant governor. So I think that they had tried to aim for diversity, but they missed the mark, and then they saw this opportunity to get Susan out of the primary. But
then Gary Winfield stepped forward and gave a very impassioned support of Eva Bermudez-Zimmerman, and I think that really it set a bit of a tone for the rest of the weekend.
No, it definitely did. I mean, diversity is important to just our society and, you know, to the Democratic Party in general. And he did. He threw his support behind Ava. And I think that it's possible that we're going to see what happened in 2006, where the Democratic primary voters teamed up John DeStefano with Mary Glassman, and she had been running previously with Dan Malloy. And so I think that it's possible that Ava Bermuda Zimmerman actually picks up enough steam that the Democratic primary voters put her with Ned Lamont, and that's the ticket that moves forward.
So Bilal, what do you see in here? Because there's two different things. I mean, I think one has to do with, are the Democrats going to have a diverse ticket all across the board, not just the top of the ticket? And that's certainly part of it. But then there's also this question about which part of the Democratic Party is really in charge at this point. Is there a progressive wing of the party that has certainly gained a lot of esteem post-Bernie Sanders across the country, but also is embodied by people like Gary Winfield and Ava Bermuda Zimmerman? And it has to do with more than race. It has to do with a kind of an outsider view of what the Democratic Party could or should be.
Right. Those are really big questions. It, you know, not don't lend themselves easily to short answers. But, you know, I think for me,
You've got all hours.
At least for me, I think of this in the larger context of what the Democratic Party nationally even faces. And this issue of diversity is a real issue for them in terms of having people of color who are, you know, the party itself is highly dependent upon those votes. I mean, African Americans make up probably, in terms of self-identified Democrats, about a quarter of the Democratic Party, which is amazing given it's only about 11% of the population. And so the party needs a very robust turnout, robust support from people of color. Here in the state of Connecticut, you need turnout from cities like New Haven, Hartford, Bridgeport. And so it's really key for the party itself and what will likely be a very tight race to get enthusiastic turnout and support from communities of color, especially in those urban areas where turnout can actually be lower. And so to me, that's the largest sort of context of folks feeling like the party needs to respond to the demographics of the state, the sort of growing role that African Americans and Latinos and other people of color play in the party, and that gets reflected in the leadership of the party. And I'll just close with this.
Yeah.
When you look at the Democratic Party in the state, you look at the delegation for Congress, all white. You look at a lot of the leadership in the state legislature in terms of key leaders, right, all white. And so from that standpoint, you have a party which really does not reflect the base of the party, not just the base, but a base that is crucial to the success of the party. And I think that's the problem.
But one thing I wanted to bring up to you, Colin McEnroe last week when we were talking about this said, you know, look, if Gary Winfield, a very popular Democrat, a progressive Democrat and someone well-known in New Haven and well-known in the legislature, not sure if he's well-known statewide, if he had gotten into this, Colin was saying, look, that's going to pick up some votes, but how many people of color are going to go to the poll specifically because Gary Winfield is there? I mean, is there something beyond the fact that there's diversity in the ticket, right, Bilal, that you think drives people from this very important, right, constituency to the Democratic Party to the polls, right, during the primary and then during the general election?
Well, and again, if you're looking at an election in November that will likely be quite close, and Republicans have been gaining momentum for a number of years, Connecticut will be targeted by the National Republican Party. Money will come into the state. Some of that money will be dark money. We'll have a hard time tracking it. But we're going to get a lot of attention. And so if you're able to raise that turnout, just even by a little bit, that could be the difference between success or failure. But I think the other thing that's interesting about this situation is that Eva announces, what, 3 days before? And all of a sudden she gets 40%. A lot of that was the result of labor and the work that labor did. And so in some ways, this is a rebuke of this sort of ticket by labor in a certain sense. And what that means is that Lamont and Bisewitz has a lot of work to do because without labor, I find it very difficult to see the Democrats winning.
Well, and let's remember that labor got very much behind Ned Lamont,
yeah,
in his run. I mean, what do you see in this, Susan?
I think we have to also think about the context of the 5th District Convention, which happened just before, and which, again, Mary Glassman won that convention against former Teacher of the Year Johanna Hayes. But she won it in this very sort of tricky kind of way where Hayes was ahead and then people can switch their votes. And this is sort of a long established, everyone can switch their votes around. But from the outside, that looks really fishy. And it almost looks like, because she is a black woman, it almost looks like you're keeping a black woman out of the race. And I think that that, in the context of the larger Democratic Party struggle with diversity, I think that that really did contribute to what Zimmerman was able to do.
And clearly, Jahana Hayes, I went to that convention, and clearly the enthusiasm was behind her candidacy. And Mary Glassman was able to, as a New Britain native, she was able to convince some of the New Britain delegation to change their votes and ended up pulling off the convention by the endorsement by 6 votes. So, but there's definitely going to be a primary. The Congressional Black Caucus is already, you know, behind Jahana Hayes and giving their support to her. So I think that it's going to be an interesting one to watch.
But it is interesting given the context of the 2016 presidential election, in which there really was this split in the Democratic Party. You've got people saying, you know, Hillary Clinton, we've heard about her forever. You know, do we really want her to be the face of the Democratic Party moving forward? And then a whole lot of other people who said, well, look, I mean, what are we looking for in politics? We're looking for a woman who's risen up through the political system, held every important job, obviously qualified. And I think an awful lot of people, a lot of women, take a look at the disparaging remarks made about Hillary Clinton and say, well, that seems misogynistic. That seems like we're trying to keep women down. And now we've got a Mary Glassman. We've got a Susan Bisowitz. People have been trying at this for quite some time, and they're almost being treated as though, well, you know, we need to get somebody else. I don't know. There's something similar to me, Bilal, in what happened in 2016 happening again to the Democratic Party.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously the tension is there, and I think it's something that the Democratic Party, and I think the Republican Party as well, is going to have to work out. I mean, part of the challenge, you know, and I looked at, you know, whether it's, you know, Stewart and New Britain or, in this case, Eva, you know, these are very young people who don't have sort of political office experience, who are being sort of catapulted, you know, and enthusiastically by a lot of people who sense that the old guard of the political parties need to change. Part of the challenge for people of color is that if you're going to move through this process and climb the leadership ladder, you need to have opportunities for leadership. And so this gets back to me, the challenge of, you know, if people are moving from the state legislature into Congress or into governorship or lieutenant governor, then they need to move through the legislature and move through the leadership and have opportunities. And there's a bottleneck that occurs. I mean, our congressional delegation is relatively young. And so if that's the case, you know, you're going to see a state in which the population of people of color is going to increasingly grow. Many of them will vote Democrat, and yet they will not be getting the opportunity to vote for people who look like them, come from communities that they have grown up in and been a part of and share experiences and background, which is not to suggest that Murphy and others are not good representatives, but for people, there's going to be increasing agitation and increasing sort of irritation about the fact that they don't have those opportunities.
One last thing before we take a break, Christine. I think a lot of people don't know who Eva Bermudez Zimmerman is. I mean, who exactly is she? Is she somebody who gets 40% of the vote at a Democratic convention only a few days after announcing that she's in the race? That is quite substantial. Well, this is not somebody who comes from nowhere, though.
No, she was running for statewide office. She was initially looking at Secretary of State since January. So she's a labor organizer. She originally grew up in Hartford. She was actually one of the chef plaintiffs. So she's from Puerto Rico. She's married to another labor organizer who's also well known at the state capitol. And, you know, she is also the sister-in-law of Ken Kryeski.
Yeah. who might be calling in here at any moment on the wheelhouse, which could happen. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this particular convention and just conventions in general. One of our panelists, Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, wonders why we have conventions at all. It's something I wonder about quite a bit. So we'll have a conversation about that with Susan, with Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and also Bilal Sakhu, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation, as always, on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can also call us at 860-275-7266 as we talk about the week's news with Bilal Sekou, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford, Christine Stewart, the Editor-in-Chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and Susan Bigelow, who is a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. We are also on Facebook Live today, which is very exciting, and we're on CTN. The cameras of the Connecticut Network are here as well, so you can see us in all different forms of media. I want to ask you, Christine, because you covered this convention, you cover a lot of these conventions. What was the mood generally at the Democratic convention this past week? And we talked about some of the infighting having to do with Lieutenant Governor. Maybe we'll talk about some of the down ticket races. But how did it feel at the Democratic convention?
Yeah, it was interesting in that it was more packed than the Republican convention. I mean, they had this huge convention center, and they decided to put us in this little teeny tiny portion of it. So it was hard to get around. I think that the excitement that we saw was mostly for the attorney general's race and the state treasurer's race. You know, the lieutenant governor's race was a little bit exciting, but the way in which they decided to do the voting, because of Lon Sideman and the Young Democrats decided this would be a more efficient way to do the voting, it kind of took some of the excitement away from your ability to kind of move a crowd and motivate a crowd and kind of see how the momentum has shifted or changed in the room.
You mentioned the AG race. William Tong, who is somebody else who we've been talking about in terms of runs for a higher office for quite some time, won the Democratic endorsement for attorney general. He's just going to face off against former federal prosecutor Chris Matty and also Senator Paul Doyle. So that's going to be an interesting race.
It is going to be an interesting race. So, you know, first, you know, he would be the first Asian American to win statewide office if he won, Representative Tong. And he's running against his co-chairman on the Judiciary Committee, Senator Paul Doyle. And then you have the former federal prosecutor, Chris Matty, you know, and the dynamics in that race are just very interesting. And I can't wait to see one of the debates.
Yeah, if we're going to have debates.
If we're going to have debates, who knows? I mean, right now, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That race interesting to you, Susan? What about the treasurer's race? Sean Wooden gets the endorsement, faces a three-way primary there. So there's some action below just what's happening at the top of the ticket.
There is. That is going to be an interesting race. But again, I'm wondering how many people are going to tune in to races that are down ballot. I think that is something that's interesting to us, but maybe not to the
general public. Only marginally. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, sorry, Chris Matty, you're only marginal.
I think they're very interesting. I'm just teasing.
No, but again, are we really going to see a lot of people be really passionate about these particular races? Maybe we'll see some, but again, I don't know.
Well, and maybe people aren't passionate about these races because, you know, Bilal, we've had, as you've said, you know, not a whole lot of diversity in the Democratic Party. I think another thing to note is that the Democratic Party has basically held control of all these statewide office seats for quite some time now. And so there's just a sense that there's another next Democrat up and that we'll end up with, you know, the full slate of not only congressional officers going to Washington, but also in Hartford as well, maybe a lieutenant governor and a governor and all these statewide office holders. And there's not a whole lot of competition maybe for some of these Democrats.
Right. Absolutely. You know, we had that conversation about the lack of diversity at the top of the ticket. But I think at the same time, you know, the Democrats should be applauded for, you know, the position of the lieutenant governor as well as the state treasurer, of course, has a long sort of history of an African-American occupying, which is part of the sort of anger that some people feel about not seeing more, you know, momentum at the top of the ticket. But I've got to admit, it might be fun to watch a comptroller sort of primary debate, you know, occurring on the Republican side. And okay, I'm a geek as a political scientist, so you guys are looking at me like, are you for real, Bilal? So I'll leave it at that. But I think you're right. This will be interesting to see if these primaries occur and, you know, how the candidates differentiate themselves with some of these, you know, offices. So there's got to be a lot of groundwork that they're going to have to do to get out into the communities to try to drum up some support in an August primary.
And I think a lot of the problem is that with the down ticket, there's a lot of competition in so many candidates at the top of the ticket. ticket that, you know, competition for not only earned media, but just, you know, to be able to get your message out there and across is going to be more difficult for them.
Well, you just mentioned the fact that it is an August primary. It happens on my birthday, don't you know it? Yeah. That's very exciting. Middle of August, nothing else is happening. And so we know not a whole lot of people are going to turn out for that, but hopefully some of these races will generate a little bit of excitement. Susan, one of the things that you were writing about, though, is because we're going to have primaries anyway, and because primaries have become increasingly important, they're really important on the Republican side nationally, because there really are different factions of the party that are vying for control of it, kind of a Trump wing and a more traditional conservative wing of the Republican Party. You see some of those splits on the Democratic side, too. So given all that, why do we have conventions anyway, these conventions we just came through? What do you think about it?
Well, why do we have these conventions anyway? And it seems to me that it doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. And the reason why we have them is essentially because of tradition, because we've always had them. This used to be the way that parties selected their nominees. Really, the primary system as we know it didn't become really the thing that chose nominees until like the 1960s or 70s. There were primaries beforehand for some offices and some races, but really it was the convention, the smoke-filled room and the party bosses who really chose the nominees. After that, the primaries became much more important, and it was seen as a much more democratic way to actually choose a nominee. So at this point, the reason why we seem to have the conventions is because, well, we've always had them, and it's a chance for party insiders to get together. But what does an endorsement of the convention really get you, besides sort of the first place on the ballot?
Well, the first place on the ballot, as we talked about last week, Liz Karandowitz, our Republican analyst, said, you know, there is some a study that suggests that that'll get you a couple points, that being on the top of the ticket really does get you something. So there's that.
Right.
I was like, probably like 3 to 5 points. But
well,
I mean,
three to five
like,
points,
yeah,
three to five
you
points
know,
in a close race.
I guess, but, you know, I don't know. I don't feel like there's no big, large party apparatus. There's no big John Bailey party boss anymore. So I'm not quite sure these conventions do anything aside from excite the party's base. And you know what? Honestly, one of the candidates for U.S. Senate on the Republican side said to me, he was like, I am shocked at how little these delegates even know about the candidates.
That's
so it was kind of like very surprising to him, you know.
And there's such a long time between the conventions and the primary that, sure, the base is a little bit excited. People are excited by the conventions. And then they forget about them for months and months and months, because there's just this huge period of time between when the convention happens and when people are actually voting for who's going to be the nominee. So the conventions, really, what did they settle for us? We knocked out one or two of the thousands of Republicans who were running for governor.
Two.
Yeah, exactly. And great. And they were people who were
three. Three, because Prasad said he's not running this week, so three.
All right, so there we go. That's one more. but these are people who were going to be, they were going to have a hard time getting traction anyway. There were Republicans who skipped the convention, the wealthy self-funders, Stemmerman, Stefanowski, they skipped the convention because what does it get them to actually compete in the convention for delegates and try to get the endorsement? They don't have to. They're going to primary. They're going to spend tons of money. They're going to blitz everybody with ads, and that might work just as well.
Ball?
I was going to say, actually, to offer a slightly different view on this, I think it's good if a convention can occur and you do knock out the pretenders, right? The people who really don't have a viable shot, who don't have much support within the party. And so if conventions are able to do that, that's really a good thing. In the ideal world, conventions would, in fact, help to rally the base. But I think the problem now is that there's such a disconnect between a kind of elite level discourse and activity that goes on with conventions and with the folks who run our political parties, and the disconnect from them to the base of the party. Because to me, ideally, the convention would be the place where people would come out excited about the candidate who has been endorsed by the party. If you don't have a situation like you have now where you have lots of primaries occurring. But in that sense, perhaps the problem is the conventions are not serving the role that they should serve, because they've really become a place where elites sort of gather within the party insiders gather and sort of rally themselves, but really aren't fully connected to the people that the party is supposed to represent.
Well, and they do sometimes what Susan was talking about earlier, which is you seem to have a result, a Jehanna Hayes coming out, a very exciting new candidate, and then there's some vote switching and some arm twisting, and then all of a sudden the party machinery gets what it wants, I suppose. And it I don't know, Susan, it gives people this sense that there's something happening behind a door that they can't necessarily see, and that lack of transparency in the process is one thing that I think continues to come back and bite political parties. If you're not transparent about who you're really supporting, I don't mean to bring everything back up to the 2016 election, but we did learn an awful lot about how people feel whenever one side seems to be putting its finger on the scale against another side in the same party.
It's true, and it really does go back to that. But of course, that sense that the political parties kind of rig things against more populist candidates like Bernie Sanders, for example, that goes back a long way. So, yeah. Democratic Party has a big problem with this because of the idea that the Bernie Sanders people feel that the primary was rigged in a lot of ways towards Hillary Clinton. And so do people feel now that the party insiders are rigging things against more progressive candidates or more populist candidates? And it makes people pretty angry with the Democratic Party, less likely to support.
Mm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that it sends a bad message. I think that, you know, there were a lot of young delegates at the 5th District Convention, and this might have been their first convention and their first kind of understanding of what happens in the process. Mm. And it was not a very favorable view of democracy at that point.
I just want to quickly turn to the Republican side because, you know, we talked about the Republicans a lot last week coming out of their convention. You know, Mark Boughton got the endorsement at the party's convention a few weekends ago, but GOP rival Tim Herbst gained the backing of the socially conservative Family Institute of Connecticut. And I don't know, Boughton's support from gun rights groups is also in question. Is there another kind of divide being set up, Christine, amongst those people on the Republican side of the ticket? You know, Mark Boughton maybe not gaining the favor of some of the more hardcore conservatives.
Yeah, I think that the Republican primary is probably going to get pretty nasty. I think that there's going to be a lot of mudslinging. There's no love lost between Mayor Boughton and Tim Herbst. So, you know, I think that anything could happen and that the dirt digging is going to happen early on and probably hurt whoever the Republican is who moves on to the general.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that sort of thing could hurt the Republican in the general election, Bilal? I mean, we always say that could be a possibility. Do you think that's likely this time around?
I think absolutely. You know, Democrats will pay close attention to what is said, you know, about Boughton, and they will use that if it's really good material to use. And so, you know, it sort of takes us back to our earlier discussion about Ned Lamont and his sort of apprehension about wanting to be primary. On the other side, you see where this potentially becomes the problem, where you have candidates who are going to be attacking the nominee for the party, perhaps damaging that nominee in some sense, and then they go into the general election and you have a candidate on the opposing party who will use those attacks against you as well.
I don't know, Susan, I guess I can see that happening on the Republican side. Maybe I'm reading the Joe Ganim campaign wrong, but a lot of what he's said so far suggests to me that as much as a man who has spent time in prison can take the high road, he understands that the high road is the only road he can take in some of these things. I guess I don't know if I see Joe Ganim coming out and saying a lot of nasty things about Ned Lamont, maybe trying to differentiate himself, maybe trying to say some things about the Democratic Party and lack of diversity and respect for the cities. But I don't know if this is going to be the same sort of mudslinging that Christine is saying might be happening on the Republican side.
Well, I guess we're going to find out. I do think that Joe Ganim probably thinks he has a very sort of narrow window here, a very narrow path. But when July rolls around and the polls are bad for him, we'll see what happens. People start getting desperate and the mud does start to fly.
Mm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a big announcement that happened at the University of Connecticut this week. President Susan Herbst announced she's relinquishing her post. We're going to talk about that and some other things in the news with Susan Bigelow, who's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, with Christine Stewart, who's editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, and with Bilal Sakhu, who is associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, Bilal Sakhu, who's an associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford, go Hawks, and Christine Stewart, who's editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. We're also live today on Facebook Live. You can take a look at us either live right now, if you want to, or later on our Facebook page. On Monday, UConn President Susan Herbst announced she's relinquishing her post and will return to teaching as a faculty member at the university's Stanford campus. Here she is back in 2010 being introduced as UConn's 15th president.
Our reputation as a university in athletics, in academics, in medicine, performance, the beauty of multiple campuses is known far and wide. And the future is incredibly bright, even in these tough times. A university with big dreams and all of this talent in a state that supports higher education with so much passion cannot falter.
So that's Susan Herbst a couple years ago. Now, 8 years on, she's stepping down from her post, and we're going to get a new UConn president. A new UConn president, Bilal, coming in at a time when the state probably isn't going to be spending the kind of money that it dropped on the big flagship university for the course of, I know, 20 or 30 years. You know, we're building out of the UConn campus during the John Rowland years, all sorts of investment in athletics and academics and big buildings. And now a lot of people are questioning how much the state spends on UConn. I don't know, the new president coming in of UConn might be a job kind of like the next governor of Connecticut, a kind of a rough one. First of all, what do you see in the Susan Herbst legacy?
Yeah, it's an interesting legacy, and I think you've raised all of the points about why it's an interesting legacy. I was sort of struck, I don't know, I just have a different sort of view about the way in which state governments actually support higher education. So I was sort of struck by her comment about a state that supports higher education with so much passion. Certainly, investments were made at the University of Connecticut that should have been made years ago to really bring and modernize the campus in really important and crucial ways. And so certainly being a part of that transformation is really important to her legacy. But I think the larger picture of support for higher ed in our state and the relationship where a lot of the money does go to stores compared to some of the other campuses like Central and Southern, who rightfully feel that they are sort of stepchilds in this relationship with the state. And so it's an interesting sort of challenge ahead as we, again, make that connection with the new governor who comes in. You know, dealing with this question of support for higher ed across the state, I think, is going to be a crucial question. It's going to be key to the state's economy, the sort of direction that our state moves in, and having, you know, first-class universities that are producing students who stay in the state and work and live in the state is going to be increasingly important.
Yeah, Susan, one thing that I think really became clear during the Herbst tenure, and it wasn't certainly just her doing, it had to do with how the state was being run, what the legislature wanted to fund, what the governor had as priorities. But there became this caste system, as Bilal pointed out, which was UConn, the big flagship university, becoming a top 20 research university, getting people from all over the world to come there, lots of money on both academics and athletics, and then this whole CSU system, which serves so many people, the four campuses of the CSU colleges, all of these community colleges. Now we're at a point where UConn has all this stuff built, and we're looking at maybe contracting the community college system, which serves so many people that really need jobs.
Right, and it's important to note that that's the low-income people, that's where they go. People who don't have a lot of money, people who are not necessarily the top of their class in high school, who don't get scholarship money maybe, but these are the people who are really, really, really in need. And they're the ones who will attend the community colleges. And that's why the community colleges are so vital. They're so important. But the investment in the community colleges has been so low. And the CSU system, the same thing. That's where people who really, really need the jobs and need to, you know, that's where they're going, and it's kind of sad that the state has not invested money in them. I suspect that they're looking at UConn right now, and then there's been a lot of complaints about this. They're looking at UConn and saying, why couldn't that have been us? Why couldn't we have gotten some of that to bolster our programs, to make our campuses, a lot of which are kind of falling apart, look a bit better? Where's that passion for us?
Mm. I think that Susan Herbst has had an interesting tenure there. I think that if we want to talk about the low point of her tenure was the response in 2014 to the female students, to how the university reacted to their claims of rape and sexual assault. They ended up settling that lawsuit for $1.3 million. You know, I think that we also have the University of Connecticut Health Center and the University of Connecticut, and the two of them play kind of a competing role for dollars here. And that, you know, it's a public hospital. It's one of the only public hospitals in the country. And so, you know, there's the schools with that too. The bonding dollars that have gone to the University of Connecticut. I'm not quite sure that, you know, we've made the University of Connecticut into the research institute that Susan Herbst talked about.
Well, in terms of the national rankings, which right. you can either take with a grain of salt or not, it has risen up the ranks of research universities. And I don't know, you're in academia, Bilal, that, you know, those rankings, you can take them or leave them. Sometimes they tell you something about a university, and sometimes they don't mean a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah. I mean, they can be important for parents who are shopping around for an institution to send their kid to. And, you know, certainly from my experience at my institution, you know, when parents come out, you know, those rankings matter, but also what matters is the way the campus looks. I mean, students are coming, and they're excited about seeing cafeterias that are first class, dorm rooms that are first class, and other sort of administrative buildings. And so UConn didn't look that way 20 years ago. It didn't look like a top 20 university.
But
it certainly
also,
has changed a
but
lot.
But there has been this investment all across the country in this sort of thing in different schools. But they also need really great professors like you, right? And you go in and you meet people who are going to inspire you and teach you and spend time with you and actually teach your classes, right? Not hand it over to a graduate assistant. And I think that there's something to be said for that and the investment in the, in the personal capital that is at the heart of every academic institution.
And I think as you move up the food chain and you invest more in the research and you reward it among faculty members, you increasingly rely on the adjuncts and the contingent faculty to work while folks are out doing their research. To me, the bigger problem, you know, structurally for our state is just the way in which support for higher ed just needs to be raised much higher than what it is right now, and it needs to be prioritized in a way that it isn't being prioritized. But it's not just a Connecticut problem. It's a national problem where state support to higher ed has really declined dramatically, while at the same time tuition and room and board has increased. And so when Susan talks about, you know, the community colleges and the state, you know, like the CCSU system, being a place where more moderate and lower income students are going, you know, the problem is that even when they go there, the bill that they get and the amount of debt that they have to incur in order to get that education puts them in a position where they're really working with something that is practically unmanageable, you know, for them, you know, once they leave college. I mean, leaving with $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 worth of debt for a bachelor's degree is just incredible, and it's a black eye on our country and something that we need to really address that we haven't addressed the way we should. Yeah.
Going back to the rankings, though, the one way that I think they really do help is they help attract graduate students, and they help attract graduate students from out of state. Graduate students are where the money is because they pay more money. They usually don't have scholarships or financial aid as much as the undergraduate students do. So that's where you're making money. And attracting those graduate students to come to your campus to be your TAs or your graduate assistants, to do research there, that's really important, especially because the population of high school age kids in New England has been dropping and dropping and dropping. This is a problem for all of our colleges.
I want to turn to something that I know Colin would want to talk about here, Christine, if he were here. And it has to do with how a lot of people in our state, people who didn't even go to the University of Connecticut, and people outside of our state view the university, which is it's this amazing basketball factory. All of these national championships in both men's and women's basketball, it is iconic in that way. But there's an awful lot of complaint within the state about the amount of attention and dollars paid to the athletic programs, maybe at the expense of some of the academics.
Yeah, I mean, it is our flagship university, and its athletic programs have done very well over the years. And now that we are in this sort of this more national conference in which the university has to travel all across the country instead of traveling, you know, when we were in the Big East, instead of traveling, you know, just on the East Coast, which cost a lot less money. It's costing us more money to send our teams around the country, which is a good promotion marketing tool for the university itself, good public relations. But it's actually the university is subsidizing its sports programs to the tune of $30
million. $30
million. $30 million.
So they're subsidizing it, meaning that the university is paying out
yes.
just to make sure that all these teams can travel. Obviously, the basketball program probably bringing back a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But programs even like football are costing lots of money.
Well, the football program is, you know, probably the most problematic when we went from 1A or 1AA to Division I. That is a lot of the cost driver. I mean, you have a huge football team, lots of travel. And that is costing the university a lot of money.
People always say, Bilal, that there's an intangible benefit, even a tangible benefit, to what Christine was talking about. The UConn name gets out there because of sports. People see it. People want to come to the university. It raises the profile. Is it worth $30 million a year of subsidy?
There are very few institutions across the country in which athletics pay for itself. And so that's just a no-brainer that you in the sense that you're going to have, if you're going to do athletics and you're going to do D1 athletics, you're probably going to subsidize in some way, whether it's through student fees, for example, or money just coming out of the general budget. This is a debate that goes on at institutions across the country, and this sort of links to my larger point about we've had this spirit of austerity around funding for higher education, and it's created this real crisis on many college campuses where people are saying, we choose between athletics or we choose between what we do on the academic side. And so this is an increasingly tough debate to have across, you know, the country because of the arguments that are made about what athletics may bring in terms of national attention. I never heard of the University of Connecticut except when I got interested in coming to Connecticut. It was that year that the men's and women's basketball team were ranked like number one in the country. And so that put them on the radar for me. And so I think for many people, they look at that and say that's the tangible benefit. But I think on the other hand, subsidizing $30 million in this period is just unconscionable.
It is. And really, this is a problem across the country, that sports teams are getting so much attention and so much money. The highest paid employee in almost every state is a coach. So this is a big problem for the entire country, for universities across the country. And it's something that is really hard to have a conversation about because alumni and fans get so passionate about it.
I want to just quickly say that our friend Danny Haar, who is often on this panel, he's on vacation this week, but he's actually tweeting at us right now about this. He says, and I'll put this to you, Christine, two strong UConn supporters have expressed general interest in jobs as college presidents, Dan Malloy and George Jepson. Have we heard anything about that, about who might take this job, and is it somebody coming from the political class?
No, I haven't heard that, but that actually, it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility that would be something that both of them or either of them are interested in.
We have just a minute here, Christine, but before we go, speaking of sports and big-time athletics, there's sports betting coming to the entire country, including to Connecticut. Very quickly, what's Dan Malloy doing to try to lay the playing field for sports betting in our state?
So basically, he's having a conversation with legislative leaders today, but he's going to have a conversation with the tribes who, according to George Jepson, don't have exclusivity over sports betting. That's not part of the compact right now. But Malloy wants to negotiate something with the tribes so that they can be able to lay the groundwork for having a special session to allow for sports betting. And there's going to have to be a lot of players at the table here.
And what does this do to any of the conversation about casinos in the state? Because we're already in these negotiations with the tribes about, are we going to build another casino? Is MGM going to get an opportunity to build another casino that's not tribal or on tribal land?
I think that they would like to separate some of that conversation away from the sports betting, because the sports betting would bring in about $40 to $80 million of revenue And allowing everybody to kind of have a place at the table might be a good thing for the state, and if we can maybe set aside this casino thing for the time being.
Are we excited about more sports betting and more revenue coming in through betting, Bilal, quickly?
No.
You are not. Are you?
OTB?
No, this is us turning into Back to the Future 2 again, where everything is miserable, but at least Biff's casino is doing well.
Back to the Future with Susan Bigelow, contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks to Bilal Sakhu, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford. Thank you, Bilal.
Thank you.
And thanks to Christine Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you so much, Christine.
Thanks, John.
Our program was on CTN, so thanks to them. Our program was also on Facebook Live, thanks to Carlos Mejia. Scott Breedy is the producer of The Wheelhouse. Katie Talarski is our executive producer. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Thanks so much to Betsy Kaplan for helping out with today's show. Well, you can always find us on The Wheelhouse at WNPR.org.